the Nelson Band was just great when you guys started that.
Oh, thank you. And
of course, I remember watching your grandparents and your father and your uncle on Ozzie and Harriet. When I was a youngster growing up, it was just it was part of Americana. It was part of old-time television.
It's pretty fantastic for us as well because we feel like we have the world's largest family for that reason. We meet people every day at our concerts, just at the supermarket, whatever. Everybody says the same thing. We grew up with your family. It kind of feels like we have the world's biggest house.
I love it. Now, tell me about this, the Guinness Book of Records. Now, three generations, right?
Well, that was a nice little fact. Our sister Tracy was on the road at the time. She was playing Rizzo in Greece on Broadway. And she was backstage getting ready for her show, and I guess it was a Final Jeopardy question. And they asked which was the only family with three generations of number one hitmakers. And it turned out to be the Nelson family, so that's how we found out. We thought it was pretty cool.
What was it like growing up as one of the Nelsons?
You know, we always thought that it was normal. We thought everybody's dad was a rock star. You know, everybody's grandparents were on TV. I mean, you got to figure, we grew up in the Hollywood Hills in the late 60s.
Yeah.
So, you know, around our house, we didn't know until later that the guy that was playing pool with our dad and wouldn't leave was, you know, Bob Dylan. Or our next-door neighbor, who was this sweet guy, used to come over and sign everything Hare Krishna, was George Harrison. And Mama Cass Elliott was our babysitter from time to time. I mean, we just thought that's what everybody's life was like. So it was kind of neat. I guess the whole point was there were always artists and music and everything around, so it seemed really normal to us.
Your grandfather started his orchestra back in the 1930s. They went into radio. They made that transition into television, and things just took off, didn't they?
They did. Apparently, Grandpa Ozzie met Grandma Harriet when he wanted to bring more guys into the audience, so he actually put out an ad for a chanteuse. And Harriet was singing at the Cotton Club at the time, and they started singing together, and as the story goes, the song or the comedic banter between songs kept on getting longer and longer, and the songs kept on getting shorter and shorter, and then Red Skelton was in the audience one night, saw their performance, thought they were hysterical, and asked them to guest on his radio show, which was a big hit at the time, and the executives at the network heard them, thought they were wonderful, and gave them their own radio show, and then, you know, Ozzie and Harriet was really born.
My sister had a crush on your dad when he was Ricky. Tell me a little bit about how the music started on Ozzie and Harriet. Whose idea was that?
Well, actually, it was really our grandfather Ozzie's idea. But there's a lot of conjecture about this, about what really happened. This is what our dad told us. He was on a date with a girl from Hollywood High School. She was a year older than he was. Her name is Arlene, and rumor has it she's going to be making it to one of our L.A. shows. I know she's in the L.A. area. We're going to put a shout-out to her, but she was the school hottie, and he was on a date, and he was driving over Laurel Canyon in L.A., and an Elvis song came on the air, and she started to swoon, and he knew that he was losing the date fast, so he said he was going to cut a record to impress her, and she laughed at him, and it made him so mad. He thought, well, I'm going to do something about it, and he went to a local store in Hollywood at the time called Wallach's Music City and sang this little in this little booth, a little demo of a Fats Domino song, and it was playing down the hallway, and our grandfather heard it, walked in, and said, "What is that?" And our dad very sheepishly said, "Well, it's me, Pop." And, of course, the light bulb went off over Ozzie's head.
Yeah.
He wrote, produced, and edited all the shows. And he wrote it into an episode called Ricky the Drummer. And a lot of people were saying, you know, you should never sing on television because it's like free milk and a cow. Nobody will buy records. Ozzie pretty much figured that they were wrong, and Ozzie was right, like he was most of the time. And the single sold a million copies that week. And, of course, Arlene knocked on the door of the Nelson House in Hollywood and said, you know, "Ricky, why don't you call me anymore about 2 weeks later?"
Yeah, let's date,
yeah,
right?
Let's go on a date. And he's just a little busy recording by that time, you know?
Well, that's something. Now, as you two were growing up as the kids of Ricky Nelson and your mom, mm-hmm. What kind of a father was he?
Well, he was a really loving guy. He was very sweet. And I know that, I mean, his music really stands by itself. It's such wonderful work that he did, but a lot of people want to know what kind of person he was. Very sweet, very gentle, a man of few words. We actually really communicated best through our mutual love of music. We just loved music so much, and I remember, I mean, he actually died when we were 18 years old, so he got to really listen to a lot of our music that we were playing professionally from the time we were 12 in all the LA clubs, and he was very, very supportive. And he gave us a few words of advice. He said, if you guys are going to do this, two things. Make sure you keep your sense of humor, because you're going to need it.
Yep.
And be songwriters first and foremost, because he always said that he would give all of his number ones from the early rockabilly years that other people had written for him, for the way he felt after a garden party that he wrote went number one. And he wanted to save us that learning curve, and it was wonderful, wonderful advice.
I remember where I was when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I was 13 years old, Matthew and Gunnar, and I remember I was in English class, and our teacher was Mrs. Leonard, and she came in crying. I remember that, and I'll never forget that moment, nor will anybody else. They know where they were. Where were you two when you found out that your father died in that plane crash?
You know, that feeling that you had, you know, we weren't around yet when Kennedy was assassinated. We were born in 67, but I got to say that it was probably something very similar and maybe turned up about 20 times. I mean, I was in my car, and I was listening to the car radio, and the disc jockey, a local L.A. station, had played three of his tunes, and I didn't really put together the tribute part. I just remembered the last notes of Garden Party ringing out and me saying to my girlfriend at the time, wow, he sounded like he had a purpose. Didn't he sound amazing? And the disc jockey came on, and this was a rock station in L.A. that wouldn't normally have played our dad at the time, kind of a heavier rock station.
Yeah,
and the,
yeah.
the jock said, this has been a tribute to Rick Nelson, who was killed earlier today with his band members in a plane crash in Texas. And all I remember was I kind of saw a flash of light, the girl grabbing me saying it can't be true. I made it about five steps out of my car, and I passed out. It's about how I heard it. And, you know, you always think that they're going to take the time to notify the family. But I guess when you're a celebrity, all bets are off. It's kind of how we learned the hard way about the media and the fact that certain rules don't apply. I remember when he died, for instance, the news stories that came out for about 2 weeks after it was the lead-out story. Every lead-out story was something about what caused the plane. There was conjecture over drugs on the plane and that causing like freebasing cocaine and things like that. It was this horrible thing. We had to see it every night. We had reporters outside our house who couldn't leave. And I remember it was the only time I've ever seen, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Dan Rather, but it was a real heavyweight newscaster actually put down his copy about 2 weeks into it and said, I refuse to be a part of this. This was a good man. I knew him. I knew the family. And I just will not do this to this man. And
good.
He moved on to the next story. And
good.
Then it ended. So.
How about you, Gunnar?
Well, you have to remember that this was on New Year's Eve, and I was hanging out with my friends. Matthew and I were actually supposed to be on that plane. We had made plans to...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, the particular plane was a World War II-era DC-3, a classic airplane that our father had bought from Jerry Lee Lewis. And we had never flown on the plane, and we had these holiday plans to actually meet him in Gunnersville, Alabama. He was playing for... his old guitar player, Pat Upton, at his club, PJ's Alley. And then we were going to join him at that show and fly with him and the band to Dallas, Texas, where they had a big New Year's Eve concert that they were going to do. And it was really strange. I know this sounds fabricated. It's not. Our father called us the day we were to leave to go to the airport. All our friends from school thought we were going to meet him.
Oh, sure.
And stuff. And he called us and he said, you know, guys, I've been thinking about this. If you're going to spend New Year's Eve with me, totally cool, but I want you to fly commercial and meet us in Dallas.
Oh, he had a feeling. He had a feeling.